Lectures to Young People by Pastor William Sprague. Preface. The plan of the following course of lectures was suggested to the author by his having often felt the need of a book to put into the hands of the young, which would yield them to counsel and instruction adapted to every variety of circumstances. Such a book he has here attempted to supply, a book designed to guard the moral principles and habits of youth amidst the temptations of the world, to impress them with the infinite obligations and advantages of religion, to conduct them through that most interesting period of anxious inquiry concerning their salvation, to bring them to cordial acceptance of the gospel offer, to assist them in ascertaining their claims to the Christian character, and to enable them to prosecute the various duties and conflicts of the Christian life in such a manner that they may finish their course with joy. Several of these lectures were written during the author's connection with the late charge at West Springfield, and the whole course was originally intended especially for the benefit of the youth of that congregation. Since his connection with his present charge, he has completed the course, and the several lectures embraced in it have been delivered in the hearing of the youth to whom he now ministers, and it is in compliance with a respectful and affectionate request from them, as well as in accordance with his original design, that the series is now given to the public. To the youth of his former charge, whose friendly attentions he gratefully remembers, and whose happiness he will ever cherish a lively interest, as well as to the youth of his present charge, whose many expressions of kindness he would gladly meet by his best efforts to do them good, these lectures are now affectionately inscribed with every sentiment of regard, and with fervent prayer for their present and eternal well-being, by their obliged friend, W. B. Sprague. Lecture 1. Importance of the Period of Youth. Proverbs 4:10. Hear, O my son, and receive my sayings. It can hardly have escaped the observation of any reader of the Bible that a large part of the writings of Solomon, and especially of his Proverbs, have a peculiar adaptation to the circumstances of the young. From this fact it is doubtless a legitimate inference that he attached special importance to the period of youth, and he was unrivaled for practical wisdom and wrote under the inspiration of God. We may fairly conclude that his opinion on the subject is correct. It is moreover an opinion which has been held by the wise and good of every age, and it requires but a moment's reflection to perceive that it is built on a correct view of the principles of human nature, and of the connection between man's character and destiny. Youth is a period of great importance. To illustrate this truth is the object of the present discourse. Number 1. The importance of the period of youth is manifest from the consideration that it is the commencement of a rational and immortal existence, the condition of which is in some important respects concealed from us. Youth is the commencement of a rational existence. There are orders of being below us which we contemplate with various degrees of interest according to their different properties. We look, for instance, with higher emotions upon the operations of vegetable life and the flower unfolding its beauties, or the tree stretching forth its boughs towards heaven, than we do upon the clods of the valley. In the brute creation we discover evidences of a still higher creating agency, for they are endued with animal life and instinct, with a capacity for enjoyment and suffering. But man, though only next above the brutes in the scale of being, leaves them in respect to his capacities at an immense distance. Superadded to his animal nature is the gift of reason, a principle which is capable of an indefinite expansion, by which standing on this earth he can measure the heavens and explore the distant parts of creation. Moreover, he has not only an intellectual but a moral nature. He has a conscience which recognizes God as a moral governor and his law as a rule of duty, and which more than intimates the fact of an approaching retribution. He is susceptible of enjoyment and suffering, not merely as an animal, but as an intellectual moral being. And it is in these higher departments of his nature that he is capable of enjoying the bliss of Seraph, or of being tortured with the agony of a fiend. However lightly man may think of himself as a creature of God, or however he may abuse his own powers, he is gifted in a manner which evidently points to some mighty result. but it were a supposable case that man might be endowed with the very powers which he now has. And yet, by an annihilating act of the being who created him, his existence might, at some future period, be blotted out. And in this case, even the mighty capacities of the soul would, in a great measure, lose their importance. But man is not only gifted with reason, but is destined to immortality. Time was when he had no existence, but in all future time he will be a living, intelligent, active being. When the foundations of the earth were laid, and the heaven spread out as a curtain, he did not exist to witness that exhibition of almighty power. But when the heaven shall be rolled together as a scroll, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, he will exist, not only as a spectator, but a sharer in those amazing scenes. And farther and still farther onward in the progress of ages, even to an interminable duration, his existence will be protracted. It is not at his option whether it shall be continued or not, for immortality is entailed upon him. And though by his conduct he may affect the condition of his being, he can never accomplish the extinction of it. But though it is certain that man is destined to an endless existence, there is much in respect to the character of it, which at its commencement cannot be known except by the Creator. This is true even in respect to the present life. No one can predict with certainty what his condition will be, even during the brief period of his sojourning here, whether he is to be signally blessed by the smiles of heaven, or to be unusually buffeted by the storms of adversity, is a problem which no present circumstances can enable him to solve. And so in regard to a future existence, we cannot decide in any respect to any one at his entrance into life whether he is hereafter to be an heir of glory or an heir of woe, a companion of fiends or a companion of angels. Such is the mutability of the world, the treachery of the heart, the sovereignty of God, that the condition of our being both in the present and future life must be in a great measure concealed from us, till we learn it by actual experience. Collect now the several circumstances which have been mentioned under this article, and tell me whether they do not invest the morning of human life as peculiar interest. It is a period in which a rational soul commences a career as unlimited as the existence of Jehovah, and attended by joy or woe which imagination in its boldest flights never conceived. And over the whole path of the soul's existence, there hangs at present a fearful uncertainty. No one can say in what manner these unfolding faculties are hereafter to be employed, whether in serving God or in opposing Him, whether in bringing upon the soul a perpetual shower of blessings or of an everlasting torrent of wrath. Is that an interesting moment when the inexperienced adventurer steps from the shores of his native country and trust himself to the mighty deep to be borne to some far distant region? How much more interesting the period in which an immortal soul commences a voyage of life, not knowing how much he may be tempest-tossed during his passage, or whether he may not even be wrecked on the dark coast of eternity. If in the former case the eyes of anxious friends follow the mariner as he goes off into the deep, it is not reasonable to suppose in the latter that the watchful regards of angels are attracted by the condition of a young immortal whose character is yet to be formed and whose destiny is yet to be revealed. Number two, the importance of the period of youth is farther evident from the consideration that probably in most cases it gives a complexion to the whole future existence. Every moral action, no doubt, exerts an influence on prevailing disposition of the person by whom it is performed. And if we could subject the character of an individual at any given period to a rigid analysis, we should find that it was precisely that which might be expected from the combined influence of all his previous moral actions. There are instances in which a single action, and that in itself apparently an unimportant one, has manifestly decided the character and destiny for life. One wrong decision has not unfrequently been the means of clothing the prospects of an individual with gloom and disgrace, while one good purpose, one victory gained over temptation, has often proved a seed which has yielded a rich harvest of reputation and virtue. But if the influence of a single action, whether good or bad, has often such a decisive and visible bearing upon future character, What shall be said of the combined influence of all the actions which an individual performs during a considerable period of life, and especially in the season of youth? It is at this period that the habits of thought and feeling and action are formed, that the inclinations usually become fixed, and the whole character assumes a definite complexion. It would seem probable, therefore, antecedently, to experience that, in general, the first impulse given to the mind and heart would be the decisive one. But what reason teaches, experience abundantly confirms. If we look abroad into the world, some indeed we shall find who have disappointed the hopes which they early awakened in respect to usefulness and piety, and others whose early life was a scene of profligacy, who have been afterwards plucked as brands from the burning. But in the great majority of instances, it will appear that the direction which the character received in youth is retained in every succeeding period of life. In far the greater number of cases in which you see old age cheered by the hopes and comforts of religion, you will find that the foundation of this tranquility was laid in the morning of life. And on the other hand, where you see hoary-headed vice shuddering in despair on the borders of eternity, it will usually be safe to conclude that the agony which you witness is to be referred especially to the early neglect of religion. Hitherto I have spoken only of the influence which the period of youth exerts upon the subsequent periods of the present life, but its influence is equally decisive upon our whole future existence. In many cases, indeed, the season of youth constitutes the whole period of life, and of course the whole period of probation. In all such instances, none can doubt that it must be decisive of the soul's everlasting destiny, nor is the case materially different, where life is continued even to old age. For if our condition in a future world depends upon our character at death, and if our character in the later periods of the present life usually takes its complexion from the period of youth, then it follows that the influence of this period reaches onward to eternity, that it is emphatically the seed time for eternal life or eternal death. Number 3. Another consideration which still further illustrates the importance of the period of youth is that it furnishes peculiar advantages for rendering the whole future existence happy or for becoming practically religious. There is a general susceptibility of character attending this period which is favorable to the cultivation of religion. I mean not to imply that the human heart is not originally the seat of corrupt inclinations, for that were to call in question not only the decision of oracles of God, but the results of every day's experience. But this melancholy truth notwithstanding, it admits of no question that there is something in the very state of the soul during the period of youth, which may be said in a comparative sense to favor the work of its own sanctification. The understanding, not having been brought under the dominion of prejudice, is open to the reception of truth. The conscience, not having had its dictates frequently opposed and trifled with, is ready faithfully to discharge its office. The various affections of the heart are easily excited, and more easily than at any subsequent period may receive a right direction. Who will not say that there is in all this a most desirable preparation for becoming truly religious, especially when the state of the soul to which I have here referred is contrasted with that almost invincible prejudice, that deep moral insensibility, which often results from long-continued familiarity with the world. Another advantage for embracing religion connected with this period is that it is a season of comparative leisure. True, it is indeed that the want of time can never be reasonably urged by any human being, whatever may be his age or condition, as an apology for the neglect of religion, but there is no period in respect to which it has so little even of the semblance of reason as that of youth. Then the cares of the world which cluster upon manhood are comparatively unknown. The more active scenes of life, the strife of business, the din of worldly enterprises, are seen and heard only at a distance. Not as in subsequent life is there a family to be provided for, and a thousand domestic cares pressing upon the heart and putting in requisition the hands. There is much leisure for serious reading, especially for reading the volume of inspired truth, which is given to be a light to our feet and a lamp to our paths. There is much leisure for serious reflection and self-examination, for applying the truth of God's Word to the regulation of their heart and life. There is much leisure for private communion with God, for Christian intercourse, for attendance on the various means of religion, in short, for everything which may be instrumental either of the renovation of the soul or of its growth in grace. The season of youth, however, may be employed, is emphatically the leisure season of life, and he who does not find time to become religious then has no reason to expect that he shall ever find it afterwards. It is another favorable circumstance in respect to the period of which I am speaking, that the efforts which are then made towards a life of religion meet a peculiarly ready and cordial cooperation from Christian friends. When the Christian looks upon the veteran in sin, who has reached an old age of carelessness, though his eye may affect his heart as he reflects upon his character and his doom, yet the hopelessness of the case seems to damp resolution and discourage effort. And even when he discovers in him some relentings in view of the past or some anxiety in respect to the future, it is difficult for him to regard even these as symptoms of thorough reformation. But in regard to the young, it is far otherwise. So much is there in their circumstances to favor religious impressions that Christians are peculiarly encouraged to be faithful towards them. This is true especially of pious parents. They look upon their children in the morning of life with a mixture of concern and hope, and they are prompted not only by Christian feeling, but a parental affection to do everything in their power to secure their salvation. Hence they often warn them of the danger of a life of sin, and urge them to enter immediately on a life of religion. Hence every indication of serious feeling on the part of their children is regarded by them as a signal to double their diligence in pressing upon them their obligations and endeavoring to bring them to repentance. Hence, too, they make them the objects of daily prayer, and not only bring them around the domestic altar, but earnestly intercede for them in the closet. Nor is these efforts for the young confined to parents. But Christians in general feel themselves especially called upon to labor and strive for their salvation. Whenever they show any symptoms of anxiety, there are many around them who stand ready to second every effort they make to escape from the wrath to come. And is it not a privilege, my young friends, thus to be wrestled for by Christian parents, thus to be borne on the hearts of God's people, thus to be counseled and exhorted and aided by those who are walking in the path of heaven? Let repentance be delayed to an old age, if indeed old age should ever arrive. And where then will be the pious mothers to embalm her supplications with her tears? Or where will be the companion in years to encourage and accompany you in the rugged path of self-denial? Or where will the Christian be found who will have hope enough in respect to you to come while your last sands are running and plead with you the earnestness which they now manifest to prepare you for heaven? As the last and perhaps the most important advantage for becoming religious, which belongs to the season of youth, I would say that the Spirit of God then, more frequently than at any other period, exerts His gracious influences. These influences He does indeed exert at every period, and sometimes even when the heart has become encrusted with the mildew of spiritual death. But experience proves that the young are far more likely to be the subjects of them than persons at a more advanced period of life. To them He speaks most frequently through the dispensations of providence, the preaching of the Word, the operations of conscience, and even the vanities of the world, and charges them to make religion the object of their immediate and supreme regard. Now I may appeal to the fact that His efficacious influences actually are exerted during this period far more frequently than in any subsequent one. That much the larger part of all who embrace religion do it in the morning of life. Let revivals of religion be brought to testify on this subject. And if I mistake not, you will find that while a multitude of youth during these scenes of divine mercy are seen pressing into the kingdom, there are comparatively few who have reached a period of middle life, and only here and there an individual from the ranks of old age. What does this fact prove, my young friends? Other than that the Holy Spirit is peculiarly ready to exert His influences in bringing you to repentance. Number 4. A last general remark illustrative of the importance of the period of youth is that it is fraught with peculiar dangers. In illustrating this article, I shall take for granted the fact that man is naturally inclined to evil, a fact which you will readily perceive must invest with much additional importance the several sources of danger to which I shall refer. There is a danger resulting from that very susceptibility of character, which has already been mentioned as favorable to early piety. For if the mind is peculiarly susceptible of truth, it is also proportionably susceptible of error. If the conscience possesses all its native sensibility, opposition to its dictates must exert a peculiarly hardening influence. If the feelings may be excited with comparative ease in favor of religion, they may even more readily be enlisted against it. And hence the melancholy fact is that in a multitude of instances, the understanding, the conscience, the affections, the whole man has become enslaved to a life of sin at the very period when he was most susceptible of the influences of piety. Let no young person then repose in the conviction that his mountain stands strong, and that he is in no danger of becoming a hardened transgressor, merely because he is occasionally roused or melted or agitated under the exhibition of divine truth. Let him take heed lest the enemy come, and avail himself of that very susceptibility, and bind him hand and foot with the cords of depravity and error, and consign him over to the most fearful destruction. Moreover, youth is a season of inexperience, and this constitutes another source of danger. Everyone knows that our most valuable knowledge is derived from experience, that it is far more accurate, more deep, more practical than any other. But of this the young, from the nature of the case, cannot in a great degree avail themselves, as it is the exclusive prerogative of riper years. They have had but little experience of their own hearts, but little opportunity of tracing out the sources of human conduct, of becoming acquainted with the evil principles which lurk within them, the treachery, perverseness, rebellion which constitute the elements of man's depraved nature. They have had but limited experience of the world, and are very inadequate judges of its true character. They have ordinarily seen only its bright side, have not often been pierced by its ingratitude, or betrayed by its faithlessness, or stung by its neglect. Of its temptations, too, of the stratagems of the wicked, of the serpentine influence of worldly pleasures, they know comparatively little. How manifestly does this want of experience give the world which they are entering a powerful advantage over them. With but a slight knowledge of themselves, they are liable to misjudge in respect to the circumstances in which they shall be safe, and put character and happiness in jeopardy from a wrong estimate of their strength to resist temptation. With but a slight knowledge of the world, they are in danger of trusting it where it intends to betray, and of being carried headlong by its influence into the vortex of pleasure and vice, while yet they have scarcely suspected that they were beyond the limits of virtue and safety. Many a youth has gone into the haunts of sin, and finally into the world of woe, because at the commencement of his course he did not suspect the danger. Again, the world has its thousand snares, and here is another source of danger to the young. There are scenes of pleasure which are misnamed innocent, which while they avoid the grossness of dissipation, wear a bright and fascinating aspect to the young, and strongly tempt them to the neglect of religion. There are scenes of profane and intemperate riot, which though enough to sicken the heart of piety, hold out a powerful temptation to many who have given a few of their first years to what is called innocent pleasure. There is a stage with all its splendid apparatus for destroying immortal souls, the most burning strains of eloquence, and the most melting strains of music. The exquisite efforts of the pencil and of the chisel are all prostituted to make an appeal to the youthful heart in favor of irreligion and licentiousness. There are evil books written with pen dipped in the poison of asps. for the very purpose of carrying to the youthful breast the elements of pollution and death. There are evil men, yes, and evil women, too, who go about preaching the doctrine that religion is a dream, and death an eternal sleep, who encircle the unwary youth, and is down sitting and uprising with the snares of death, and who are prepared to celebrate the wreck of his principles and of his hopes with a short, fin-like exultation. In these circumstances, who will not say that the most appalling dangers hang around his path? And now, in view of all that has been said, is it not manifest that youth is a period of great importance? I ask you, my young friends, whether as a commencement of a rational and immortal existence, and as a period which is probably to give a complexion to that existence, it is not too important to be devoted to any other purposes than those for which it was designed? Is it not too important to be wasted in careless levity and vain amusement and any of the unfruitful works of darkness? Are not its advantages for becoming religious too important to be neglected? Its dangers too serious to be regarded with unconcern? This critical and deeply interesting season will soon have passed away, and the period of manhood will succeed. The period of manhood, did I say? Ah, it may be the period of retribution, that in which the soul shall be mingling in the hosannas of the redeemed or the wailing of the lost. But wherever or in whatever circumstances future years may find you, rely on it, the period of youth will have contributed much to make you what you will then be, both in respect to your character and condition. Regard each moment, then, as a prize put into your hands to gain wisdom. And remember that now, emphatically in respect to you, is the accepted time. Now is the day of salvation. Lecture 2, Danger of Evil Company. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Evil communications corrupt good manners. Nothing is so valuable to man as his character. This is proverbial even in regard to the present life. Strip him of everything else and leave him with a good conscience, and what will probably attend it? A fair reputation, and all that you do will be comparatively harmless. You may have wounded his sensibility, or overcome his resolution, or clouded his worldly prospects, but he has that which in the end will be likely to place him above the power of malice. His character is a broad shield which the arrows of adversity and even the sting of detraction can never effectually penetrate. Be his circumstances what they may, the fact that he has a good conscience and a good character may justly render him contented and fearless. But if the character which is formed here to be important in its relation to our present existence, it is infinitely more so as it stands connected with eternity. This is only the period of our probation. It is a school in which we are training for an immortal existence. Every moral action of our lives will exert an influence upon us either in heaven or hell. And the sum of these actions will decide the complexion of our characters, and of course our eternal destiny. If these remarks be just, then it clearly follows that there is no part of our conduct which ought to be considered unimportant. The least departure from duty, the least violation of conscience, may be a seed which will produce a harvest of everlasting woe. It may be the germ of a sinful habit. It may be the first of a progressive series of wicked actions which will extend through eternity. It may prove the outer door to the temple of vice, and he who enters it may reasonably expect to be led on till he has explored all its scenes of pollution and darkness, until he finally sacrifices his immortal soul on the altar of confirmed profligacy. Perhaps there is no influence so uniform and so powerful in the formation of character as that of example. This results from the fact that we are creatures of imitation. There is a principle in our nature which leads us instinctively and from our earliest childhood to copy the manners of those with whom we associate. This, to a great extent, is involuntary, inasmuch the persons have often unconsciously contracted peculiarities of character, which, when they were reminded of them, they could instantly trace to the example of some friend. I do not here inquire whether we are not more likely, from our constitution, to imitate good or bad examples, but only speak of the general influence of example, of whatever kind, founded on the fact that we are naturally imitative beings. The considerations at which I have now just hinted, that with the characters which we form here, must be connected not only our present but eternal condition, and that there is no influence more powerful in forming these characters than that of example. These considerations, I think, must prepare you suitably to estimate the subject to which I am about to call your attention. I mean the danger of evil company. I wish each one of you to hear for himself, and to let conscience make a faithful and honest application. And it is my earnest prayer to God, and I doubt not that it is the prayer of your parents who are here among you, that you may so listen and so apply, that this discourse shall prove the means of making you better and happier through eternity. That evil company has a corrupting and dangerous effect is a fact so well understood and so universally acknowledged that it would be quite superfluous to enter into any direct proof of it. The wisest man in the world has long ago said that a companion of fools shall be destroyed. And who has not seen the assertion verified in instances almost innumerable? It will be more to our purpose, therefore, to show you the process by which evil example operates, or to notice the different principles which it brings into action, and corrupting the morals, degrading the character, and ruining the soul. Number 1. The danger of associating with wicked companions commences in the fact that it renders vice familiar. I know it has been fashionable to say in the language of a distinguished poet that vice is a monster of so frightful mien that to be hated needs but to be seen. And on this principle some have gone so far as to justify the most profane and licentious exhibitions of the stage, and have gravely contended that those splendid scenes of impiety, decked out with all that is most attractive and provoking to the sensual appetites, are fitted indirectly to nourish good affections and lead to a virtuous life. The fundamental error of this kind of philosophy is that it overlooks the melancholy fact that man is a being of depraved inclinations, and the moment you bring him in contact with vice, you place by his side a companion to whom his arms and his heart involuntarily fly open. However you will account for the fact, all experience proves that there is a tendency in human nature to go astray, and that while nothing more than the absence of restraint is necessary to the formation of evil habits, a habit of virtue and piety is always the result of fixed resolution and severe effort. If then the state of the heart naturally be such as to render it most sensible to the solicitations of vice, you will easily perceive how this consideration operates to invest all needless intercourse with evil company with great danger. You may apply fire to materials which are exposed to the frost and damps of winter, and you will find it difficult to produce a flame. But if you bring it in contact with some highly inflammable substance, you will see a blaze or hear an explosion in an instant. In like manner, if all our inclinations were originally on the side of virtue, the danger from being familiar with vice might be comparatively small. But the case becomes greatly changed when it is recollected that we have within us evil propensities, which are ready to kindle as soon as a torch of temptation is applied to them. I am aware that the circumstances of our present condition sometimes necessarily leads us to witness scenes of wickedness, but this, so far as it is unavoidable, is to be considered as constituting part of our trial, and as making a loud demand for our vigilant activity and resistance. But in a large part of the instances in which young persons are the witnesses of vice, it is not because Providence places them in the way of it in the course of their duty, but because they are prompted by inclination. Now let me say that those of you who have yielded so far to curiosity or any other principle, as to place yourselves deliberately and unnecessarily in the way of vice, I care not what kind it is, have unconsciously entered into a league with it. The fatal poison is already in your hand, and unless you cast it from you without delay, in all probability, you are ruined. Number two, it is a tendency of mixing with bad associates to benumb and finally destroy the moral sense. By the moral sense, you will understand me to mean that faculty or principle of action, partly of an intellectual and partly of a moral character, by which we discern the difference between right and wrong, and approve the one and condemn the other. In some, I suppose, this faculty is originally more active and delicate than in others. But in all, it is an essential part of the human constitution, and is indispensable to moral agency. It is easy to see that in the formation of character, much will depend on cultivating or neglecting to cultivate it, and of course whatever contributes to render our moral perception less accurate, or our moral sensibility less keen, must proportionally put in jeopardy our virtue. Now let me ask whether the voice of universal experience does not decide that mingling in evil company and witnessing evil examples has this unhappy tendency. Have not even persons of an established principle of piety, who have been called in the course of providence, to mingle in scenes of wickedness, found it exceedingly difficult to maintain that high and awful sense of the evil of sin, which they wish to cultivate? And have not they been obliged to fortify themselves against this deadening influence by a double degree of watchfulness and prayer? But perhaps there are some before me who can bear testimony on this subject from experience. Can you not remember the time when some particular vice, say that of profane swearing or gaming or drunkenness, excited in you emotions of disgust and even horror? When you could hardly look upon its miserable victim without an aching heart? But it may be that you have since frequently been in vicious company. The sounds of blasphemy and the rite of loathsomeness, of intemperance, have become familiar to you. And has not this familiarity rendered you insensible in a great degree to the odiousness of these vices? Nay, are there not some among you who can now commit, without much remorse, sins the very thought of which would once have made you tremble? Look back, O young man, and see how far you have already fallen towards the gulf of profligacy and ruin, and then in the light of your past experience, and over the ruins of a good conscience, look forward and prophesy concerning your future doom. The extension of the moral sense is usually very gradual, and the progress of its decline is often marked with great accuracy by the conduct. Everyone knows that conscience is originally one of the most active and powerful of all the inhabitants of the human breast, and that she will never yield up her authority till she has sustained a severe struggle. There is nothing perhaps in which this conflict is more clearly marked than in the progress of a young man who has had a pious education towards a habit of profaneness. Though he has been accustomed occasionally to hear the language of cursing from others, the impressions of his childhood are too strong to allow him immediately to copy it. At length, in an evil hour, he summons resolution enough to make the awful experiment of uttering an oath. But his faltering tongue and blushing cheek proclaim that there is a commotion and a remonstrance within. Conscience rouses up all her energies and thunders out a rebuke, which almost puts him in the attitude of consternation. Perhaps his early resolutions to reverence the name and authority of God come thronging upon his remembrance, or perhaps the instructions of other days enforced by parental affection, rise up before him. Or it may be that the image of a departed parent, who had trained him up in the way that he should go, haunts his busy and agitated mind and reproaches him with filial ingratitude. He resolves that the dreadful privilege of taking the name of God in vain has been purchased at too great expense, that he will not venture to repeat an experiment that has been so fruitful in remorse and agony. But presently he is heard to drop another oath and another, and in each successive instance, the conflict with conscience becomes less severe till at length this faithful reprover is silenced, and he blasphemes his Maker's name without remorse, and almost without his own observation. When I see an ingenious youth taking the first steps in this path of death, when I see his countenance change and hear his voice falter, and the embarrassment and awkwardness of his manner tell me that conscience is uttering his remonstrances, at the very moment when the language of profaneness is upon his lips, I say to myself, poor young man, little do you know what disgrace and wretchedness you are treasuring up for yourself. I regard him as having set his face like a flint towards perdition. And I read on his character in dark and ominous letters, the glory is departed. It is important here to be observed that the effect of any particular vice in destroying the moral sense is universal. That is, by being familiar with any one sin, the mind gradually contracts a degree of insensibility to all others. For instance, if you indulge in profaneness, the sin of licentiousness or drunkenness as an offense against God will not appear to you in its native odiousness, for this plain reason, that by indulging sin of any kind, you lose your regard for God's authority. There is also such an intimate connection between different vices that it is exceedingly difficult to be devoted to one without being in a greater or less degree the slave of more. Remember, therefore, that in frequenting the company of the vicious, you expose yourselves not only to the particular vices which you may happen to witness in them, but to any others to which subsequent temptations may invite you. Because when you have once cast off the fear of God, your heart will be open to every bad impression, and you will be a soil in which every kind of sin will flourish luxuriantly. Number 3. It is another effect of associating with evil company that it checks the operation of the principle of shame, or renders one regardless of the opinion of the world.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.